Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Paul Kent. Paul is a top-ranking business and industry leader and a KIPPS Fellow, recognized for outstanding lifetime contributions to information technology in the industry. Paul, thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience.
No, I'm pleased to be here, Stephen.
Paul, I was just looking at your background, and we can learn from your long history of substantial and sustained successes. Can you profile some of your key roles and the insights and career lessons that you gained from them?
Well, I've been active in the workforce. I have a hard time saying this, but for 31 years, 15 of those came directly from a public sector sort of assignments, and 16 years in the private sector, so about 50-50. While I was within the public sector, which was largely provincial government, My work was very technical, more around software development, software analysis, network technicians, things of that sort. But at about a third of the way through my career, I was approached and joined a very prominent consulting organization, DMR Group, where I had 10 very good years, where I was a practicing consultant. Largely in management consulting and project management, which was a very instructive time, as it really really caused me to broaden my interest away from a very sort of technical, siloed perspective of the world. DMR was subsequently acquired by a large Japanese interest, the Fujitsu organization, a multinational organization, where I began to take on more management and leadership roles. Got focused there on the profit and loss, they're basically the consequences of the work that one does in the information technology realm, and had the opportunity then to work with some extremely interesting customers and clients, such as when I think about Atlantic Canada, I think of the innovation and the creativity and the daring of NBTEL in years past. Most recently, joined the Alliant and X-Wave organization, the telecommunications ICT world, which was a great opportunity to participate in one of the largest sort of transitions of any industry that I can recall, the convergence of IT and C, where I was asked to run the X-Wave organization to ensure that we optimize its relationship with its parent company, Alliant, and where once again I was and have been exposed to some extremely talented people and some very, very challenging work assignments. And you ask what lessons I've gained through that whole process. I think one of the things I've learned is that it's not about technology. You know, one's working life is all about relationships, and it's all about building effective two-way relationships, and it's about the exchange of value. And it's a world in which talented people can do very, very well, but it's also a world where simply possessing technical competencies simply just doesn't cut it. It's a world where an employee comes competent to the table, but at the same time has to demonstrate various life skills in order to be seen as valuable by others. So it's been a great time. I'm actually now between assignments, having taken a bit of a sabbatical, and very shortly should be landing somewhere else, where I hope to take the next step in what has been a very interesting and highly satisfying career.
You know, that's interesting. You've had some really great leadership roles. Are there sort of tips that you want to give to other IT professionals who are seeking leadership roles?
Well, there's many models of leadership. I have found for myself that the most natural way to lead is from the bottom up. You could call it servant leadership. As you can well imagine, if I was to behave as a leader in a pompous or a king-like manner, it certainly doesn't work when you're working with extremely talented professionals, such as are often present in consulting organizations. And certainly, I can say I've worked with clever people through all of my work experience. Leadership is about setting direction and defining a strategic target, and then motivating those resources that you're given, human, financial, and otherwise, to get to that goal. And I have found that the best way to do that is from the middle rather than from the top. And that certainly has worked in my case. It doesn't work in every context, I would have to agree, but in the business situations I've been in, it's been a good style to have.
You know, specifically in terms of your career, you became a KIPPS founding fellow in 2006 for your significant lifetime contributions to information technology, the profession, and industry. What further contributions do you wish to make?
Well, I'm probably in the last 25% of my career, and I really value the very extensive network that has developed through the years. It's something which I've, in essence, taken from for a long time. I really feel the compulsion now to really contribute the other direction. In that sense, basic activities such as mentoring and coaching junior people, the junior folks that are looking at the IT industry, students, something I thoroughly enjoy is pretty well on an annual basis. I stand in front of an MBA class or a business or a computer science class at one of the many universities in Atlantic Canada and just talk about the merits of an IT profession. But also, I think the need to promote the profession as a profession, not simply work, and the very distinct need then for an interest in certifying the professional base that we have within the country and in participating in global efforts where we look for standardization of the certification process so that we can recognize each other's capabilities from country to country. These all become very important in a world which is increasingly global in the way that it behaves, and it's very important so that the working population that is present in Canada that does choose an IT profession can find work and be recognized for the capability that they represent.
I noticed in your background you got your ISP, or Information Systems Professional designation. Can you go into more detail about that?
Well, that was very important. I did seek that designation fairly early in the process, and you know, KIPPS has been around for a long time. It's really had certification for you would probably know how long, but to me it appears, I'm thinking probably 15 years, 17 years. I sought it early on, first and foremost, as a way of personally coming to grips with what it was that I was doing. It was an opportunity to almost self-test myself as to the credibility of the career journey that I was on. It was also an excellent opportunity to have that validated by your peers and to have a sort of a critical assessment of the process of building what I thought at the time was a pretty good career, but you know, clearly there wasn't that many formal opportunities for that kind of input. So it was very valuable. It's since that time been very helpful to me because when I see the designation ISP after somebody's name who I may not know, I instantly know something about that individual, and it certainly provides a starting point for conversation and discussion. And I probably have hired hundreds of people through the 30 years that I've been active in the industry, and I can tell you that it really helps when you see that sort of designation because it's almost an implied stamp of approval. It certainly tells me that I'm working with somebody who has been serious about their career.
You know, in terms of technology itself, you really have kept abreast of what's happening in all the different roles and so forth. How do you see the technology landscape building in your region as compared to globally in the rest of Canada?
Well, that's an interesting question because last year, pretty well around this time, I traveled to India to the NASSCOM IT Leaders Conference, which happens in Mumbai. And I went as a leader of, well, I was very active with the IT Association of Canada, and the IT Association said, would you mind leading this delegation to Mumbai? So I traveled with a number of individuals from various companies from across the country, and then was confronted with the might and momentum of the Indian IT scene, the Chinese very present, the Filipinos very present, Eastern Europe very present, and so on. And I came back with one large question in my mind, and that was to really critically ask the question, what is Canada's role in the world of global IT sourcing? What I found there was that there is significant capability within Canada. It's understated. I think our natural behavior to be fairly resigned and careful and somewhat introverted gets in the way, but we certainly do have a capacity to do far more than we actually have been doing on a global scale. With respect to Atlantic Canada, which of course is a part of the world that I've worked in for so long and I know rather intimately, and I think most people would agree, there's an extremely large indigenous base of IT capability within this region. It's competitively, I think some of its attributes are that it is very loyal and very stable. It certainly doesn't behave like mercenaries, such as perhaps an IT professional might be in downtown New York City or something. It is very capable, and it's renewable, and it's renewable because there is a very large number of post-secondary schools here, both community colleges that are very credible, as well as very very good, some of the best universities in the country. And they all have an emphasis on IT and related disciplines, so business and IT or medicine and IT and so on. So, recently there's been quite an uptick of economic interest from the economic development departments of the various provinces, and there's been a lot of success. So we all know that RIM have made a very significant strategic decision on their part to locate a significant center in Halifax. It's the first time they've really left Waterloo. We also probably know that CGI is extremely active both in Prince Edward Island and Nova Scotia now. Keene Consulting, the company from Boston, also have a very significant presence here. So I think the attitude here with IT is really rather bullish, and if anything, we're now concerned about supply. We certainly haven't hit the bottom of the well at this point, but there is, and it's probably appropriate to begin to talk about immigration and other alternatives for supplementing the local base. But meanwhile, it's very healthy.
You know, what are your views on ways to align IT with business needs or driving business agility or managing risk through improved governance?
Well, you know, with 30 years of doing this, my goodness, you know, the same questions exist. I've seen the days of control-centered IT departments that were really where they were data processing departments in those days. I've seen the loss of that control, the IT department becoming a facilitator, and today I really embrace the notion that IT is so intrinsically part of business that it is really an aspect, it's an area of focus, it's a way of understanding the asset base of an organization that is tightly integrated with all of the corporate plans. Clearly, the constructive use of technology can help companies accomplish their productivity objectives, can certainly help them exploit new markets, can certainly help them innovate. All of these things can be done, but increasingly in an integrated fashion with the whole business. So that has been a challenge to IT professionals because, you know, clearly the business leaders are the ones that are calling the shots about how technology is to play in their business and to what extent and in many cases even choosing the options. But which has really forced the IT professional to find a way to really understand the business and speak the language of business and to be a partner with the business professional in making sure that these choices are the right choices in the long term. So the days of IT plans are likely numbered. However, IT plans that respond to a business plan are all the more important.
You know, that's interesting. So what would you say would be more valuable to an IT practitioner who's sort of building their career as an MBA or a master's in computer science?
Well, there isn't one answer to that question. It really depends on what one intends to do. To be completely without an appreciation for the outcome of the application of technology, be it in business or society in general, I certainly would frown on that. That would certainly be a very insular view of the world, where you're just so focused on the elegance of a technology that you don't understand its impact when it's in use. Business people certainly value working with individuals that are fluent with technologies, but at the same time understand the drivers, the context for the business in which it's to be applied. And the more that an IT practitioner can do that, the more valuable they ultimately become. Frankly, I believe, you know, to the students of our schools, the more interesting the profession becomes, if that's an expected requirement.
You know, earlier you talked about the fact that supply could be an issue. And so how can we close the skills gap and meet future skill shortages?
Well, and IT is not the only industry that is projecting diminished employment. This is largely an outcome of the post sort of baby boom era. Clearly, immigration and an aggressive pursuit of talent. I'm not sure who said it, but there is a quote that I've read that says, "He who has the most talent wins," and I think that applies even on a national level. And also, I think there's a necessity to return to some models that we used aggressively prior to the technology bust of around 2000, when there was a very active interest of business in supporting higher education. And I believe the issues are so acute that that now will extend to actually getting out and talking about IT as a valid career at high school levels. So, you know, organizations like KIPS, organizations like ITAC or CADA, these organizations and their relationship with, you know, possibly organizations like Junior Achievement become very important because they create the right perception and the right facts for students who are choosing career options.
I guess this also ties into some of the work you do, because I know that you do outreach to students of all different types, and you're constantly speaking about IT and careers and so forth. So your vision ties in with your passion in terms of what the needs are in the marketplace.
Yeah, it's, you know, when I think of my career, I think of four or five people that have been you know, mentors to me for many, many years. And there are actually some individuals who I might have worked with as much as 15 to 20 years ago who I honor significantly every time I move through one more career intersection. And on the day that I retire, those people will all be brought together because they played a significant role in my career. So I'm at a stage right now where hopefully I will have the same impact on others. So it's always been almost an obligation to me. It's a core part of who I am to make myself available to young entrepreneurs, young IT talent, students that are, you know, caught with that dilemma about what am I going to do with my future, to spend a bit of time with them. And the fascinating thing is that every time you do it, you come away with you know, great admiration for the future welfare of the country. Some of these people are going to be looking after me someday, so I'm honored to help them out.
You know, one of the things that I hear about is the productivity gap of Canada versus other countries, and it's related to ICT adoption. What are your views on that?
Well, I think it's absolutely true. You know, here in Atlantic Canada, which again I apologize to your listeners, but I certainly know it well. There are really two economies. There's a new economy and there's a legacy old economy, and there's two different ways of thinking in both of those. And how one reconciles the existence of those two is the dilemma of government, and it's certainly the dilemma of the businesses that serve both those populations. But there is a significant productivity gap, no matter how you look at it, between Canada and other industrialized nations, and we're a country that you know, my view, isn't concerned enough about that. Technology is and can be used as a lever for increased levels of productivity, and I think quite rightly has been identified as one area of focus in resolving the productivity issue. A ton of this is education. I would say that a prejudice almost within economic development agencies of the country towards simply finding employment has to give way to finding the right employment. And the economic development policies of the various jurisdictions of the country have to start, I think, very aggressively deciding which industries they want to be part of going forward. And as challenging as it will be, certain other industries, and in many cases in my area of the world, that's perhaps manufacturing businesses, have to go elsewhere because we can't win the productivity battle in those cases. Now, I'm at the same time, I'm quite fascinated by some of what I've been watching and reading lately, where we find a way to, as a country, retain the knowledge side of the business and farm out the manufacturing. That particular alternative raises other possibilities for, deciding what aspects of business we retain and then ensure we're fully productive in those areas of business, probably more knowledge intensive, and what are those things that we farm out to other economies that are able to do it in a way that we can only wish for.
Now, I conduct a fair number of interviews, and I did one with Don Tapscott, who's a co-author of the book Wikonomics, and I did another one with Michael Furtick, who's sort of a serial entrepreneur, but he's quite young. One of the things that I'm hearing out there is this whole concept of Gen Y, the millennials, those people who are born post-1980, and the impact that they're going to have, and the fact that organizations are not really properly sort of addressing this or preparing for this sort of huge influx, because the attitudes are different. What does this mean, and can you sort of comment on this?
Well, I've got two teenage daughters, one's 16 and one's 20, and they are wired differently. You know, their only understanding of the world is a post-internet world. Connectivity is not an issue. You know, I remember the days of 300 baud TTY connections. Connectivity is not an issue. Globalization, it to them is an opportunity. It's not a challenge. They're not threatened by it. The world is tiny. We all in countries are treated more like boroughs of a larger world entity. And they believe everything's possible, and they believe in themselves. I see a confidence in these young people. I think that's going to lead to a different definition of employment. I think it's going to be that profound, because the other thing these kids are is they seek challenge, bond easily, they trust quickly, and I believe that they're going to be quite mobile. So I think the nature of employment is going to change. Assignments will change. Consulting, there'll be a lot of consultants because there'll be a lot of sole practitioners, so to speak. And this community is going to be impatient. They're not going to see the roadblocks that we perpetually see. I'm sorry to put you in my group there, Stephen, but at least what I see, and they just want to move on. So I think that sort of inclusive, energetic, fairly positive attitude is going to change the nature of work.
So what can we do to reach out to this group or embrace them and incorporate them, especially more established businesses who may not have a handle how to, you know, engage and empower this group?
Well, you know, that's more a sociological question, isn't it? It's really around, you know, how does the old guard give way to the new? Some go kicking and screaming, and some move on. I think inclusion. You know, I always value that new perspective around the table. That's just my style. I also value wisdom, and one of the byproducts of the cull of so many senior managers back 15 or so years ago is that a number of organizations lost the wisdom of age. So that I think there's a need to do both, because we're an aging population at the same time, and there's more old people around than there were, and they continue to be valuable as well. So I think it really comes down to leaders that are inclusive and willing to listen to a variety of perspectives and willing to bet on younger points of view at times, you know, largely because of the credibility of what they're hearing.
Now, can you share your views on the top challenges facing business, industry, government, education in 2008 and beyond?
Well, you've already referenced productivity, and that's a huge one, and closely related to that is the relative competitiveness of our country and of the products and services which originate here. Another concern, which I think is a Western concern, it's not necessarily just Canada, is the very short-term thinking. You know, the risk management mania that has come since the corporate misdeeds of a number, the Enron scandal and so on, has created a compulsion to over-govern and also shorten your time horizons for performance, because we also have an extremely impatient investor community. And all of that is likely undermining the ongoing strength and vitality of the corporate sector. So I worry quite significantly about that, particularly in Canada. You know, I worry because we are not that large economically, and we could slide. So competitiveness, productivity, short-term thinking. The aging workforce, and you know, my reference to the wisdom of this aging workforce, but at the same time, the very profound changes that are going on in the world around the nature of work, the way businesses interrelate, globalization, and these things are things that have to be well managed. In my part of the country, there's a significant stress between rural and urban priorities. The context for living in rural Nova Scotia or rural Newfoundland is quite different to what it is in the urban core. St. John's, Newfoundland is a bustling economy, and yet you can you head out into the outports and you're looking at a vastly different context. And then from the point of view of leaders, I think there's at times a real lack of courage and willingness to try new things. Risk aversion has become the stock and trade of business in North America, while we watch China, who go out of their way to build shipyards and such basically on spec, that they intend to dominate this space in the world. So the self-esteem of Canada on a global level, I think, is suffering because of a lack of confidence in doing what we can do very, very well. All of those things ultimately, you know, undermine the momentum of business. And in a world that is global, the talent that we so value today, and if you do believe that they're going to be involved in exciting endeavors, we have to be careful that we don't lose them to other countries and other places where the perception is that the game is all the more exciting and interesting.
Do you have some additional ideas in terms of how these challenges can be addressed?
Well, it's really going to take, and by the way, I'm positive about all of this. I feel the winds of change at my back quite a bit. I do believe that that Canada is waking up from a very quiet, quiet time. It comes down to leadership, and leadership across all sectors, and government, academia, business, government at all levels, leadership around a positive view of the future, an opportunity view of the future, the willingness to grasp opportunity, and the willingness to use the very rich resources that we have in the country, human, financial, physical, all the various resources to the advantage of you know, one of the best places in the world to live.
You know, Paul, you're an acknowledged top-ranking thought leader, so I'm always sort of curious about what your thoughts would be on this particular area, and that is sort of the trends in business and technology and their implications and opportunities they would provide.
Well, there's macro and micro trends. I've referenced globalization, which represents potential and risk. But at the same time, we're also a world that is, the Western world anyway, is largely, how would I characterize it, afraid. So issues of security and the expense of security, the reality of a secure world, all of those sorts of things obviously are driving, they're driving innovation, they're driving defense budgets, they're driving policing and border security, and they're driving biometric technology, all of these sorts of things. Along with that is concerns about privacy, confidentiality, the right. You get into certain principles of our society about, you know, freedom of thought, freedom of expression. At the same time, then there are going to be the need for numerous technologies which will allow the privacy levels to be maintained. And then I'm quite fascinated by the impact that miniaturization, you know, PC in a pocket, mobility, and its intersection with geography, the ability to locate anything anywhere on the planet, at the same time the ability to speak, talk, see, manipulate anything anywhere on the planet. All of these things, mobility, privacy, security, globalization, all of these things are changing the way we behave. They're changing the way we interact. and they're changing the way companies interact with their customers, the way companies understand the customer. And I can only think that that's going to have massive implications going forward. Some good, some bad, some where we're going to need laws to protect ourselves, and some where laws are not necessary so that we can, achieve, the full benefit of innovative and creative ideas using very advanced technologies.
Paul, we spent quite a bit of time talking about sort of the broader community, business and industry and so forth. I want to focus on you personally, from a personal perspective. What are the things that you hope to achieve in 2008, and then going beyond that, perhaps for the next 5 years?
Well, I spent 2007, at least the summer and the fall, and sit here today between jobs, taking a sabbatical, something I actually would recommend to everyone. It's been really excellent, having left an excellent job with Alliant and X-Wave. And I'm now in a situation where I'm assessing various opportunities for my next move. In order to do that well, you have to really understand what it is that you want to be doing. And I've come to grips with in just a couple of words. I clearly want to have an impact on whatever organization I'm associated with next. Positive impact, I hope. There are negative ones, I guess. But a positive impact. Every role I've had through the 30 years I've been working, there have been takeaways, there have been valuable lessons, or there have been educational opportunities, or I've met very, very interesting people. I would hope that in my next role that's happening again. The other thing I'm very proud to say is I love where I live. I think the world of the country of Canada, I wasn't born here, I was born in England, and my parents made a great decision to come here. And the part of that country that I live in, Atlantic Canada, I have an even higher regard for. And I'm pretty proud of what it does. So I hope it's a role in which I can continue to be a promoter of what we do very well here. As I said, at the end of the day, making a difference, learning something along the way, and drawing satisfaction from that. I think that's what I'm looking for. Now, you said over the next 5 years, I'm not going to be one who works until I'm 80. I'm 51 today, and I don't think I will be working into my 60s. I intend to see this world, and my career plan has me sort of going idle at least for the winter months, so I can get away by the time I'm in my late 50s. So over the next 5 years, I will probably, if I have my way, conclude my employed life and then move into whatever comes after that. So my decisions over the next few months are so important because it's quite conceivable this would be the last role that I play in my career.
Well, that's interesting in terms of, because you also talk about contribution and so forth, and that sort of reminds me out of a keynote that he gave at an informatics conference around professionalism and IT, where you were sort of giving your perspective of what that means and the value of professionalism and information technology. And that's all about contribution again. You have this sort of life history of contribution. Can you kind of share some of your views about that?
Well, some of this is just bred into you. I was very lucky to have two parents that really drove four boys, I'm the eldest of four, to make a difference. And they have always been heavily involved in community and in being an example, I guess, and so have my brothers and I. So we are really quite driven to do that. So even as I anticipate retiring in say the next 5 years, I know very well that I will continue to contribute in various ways, professionally through an IT association certainly, or through a professional association like KIPP, but also through other organizations that I've been a part of, which I believe accomplish a good community service. I anticipate doing that for the remainder of my days, frankly, because it's just the way we've been wired to do it. Sadly, there's a lot of people in business that, and this is going to sound a little critical, it is in many respects, that will only really become involved in community-based support or whatever if it really serves the needs of their business, and they're way too rigid about that. And but then again, there is a subsection of the working population that are really driven to do this, and they're really fine people to know because they really do understand that we work so that we can live, and not the other way around. And work then is a component of leading a beneficial life, and so giving back is just the way it's done.
You've done some thinking though in terms of professionalism and the whole field of information technology. What are some of the values in terms of professionalism and technology, the value proposition of that whole area?
A question that, as you've said, I've spoken on a number of times. I guess one has a choice to be a worker or to be a professional, and I've had conversations with staff through the years who have been exhibiting worker characteristics, not profession characteristics. If one is a professional, you own your profession, you own your body of knowledge, and you contribute to it because you intend to be known as a professional. And you know, my language is a bit raw here, but the point is that a professional wears their competence on their shoulder proudly, knows the importance of it, is able to exhibit the discipline, able to demonstrate ethical behavior, value-based behavior that is required of a professional. The work of an information technology practitioner is increasingly critical. It is part of every business. It's part of every aspect of society. The requirement for that particular activity, the activities associated with IT professionals, to be done at the highest standard by competent individuals has never been any more great. In the old days, we'd say, you know, if you didn't do the aircraft systems right, airplanes would fall from the sky. But we're now to the point that you can't even buy groceries at a store if the computer system goes down. And although that may not be as cataclysmic as a plane falling from the sky because the flight navigation system failed, it is still just as troubling to many when you can disrupt the operation of a business so significantly. So there's never been a need anymore for certification than there is today, because it is unfortunately a realm which is at times infiltrated by people that that are not professionals, and so there is a need to separate those individuals who have chosen to make this their core competence and who intend to invest in it, intend to abide by the disciplines of the profession. There's a need to set them apart from other folks who may make a living at it, but are simply not in the same realm. And I'm careful not to speak of haves and have-nots and so on, or any sort of exclusive behavior, but there's a need to categorize, codify a body of knowledge and competence and requirements of professionals who are going to do critical systems which affect our lives.
So what role do you see KIPS playing in the broader community in business and industry, government, education, and internationally?
Well, in Canada, KIPS has somewhat through design, and I think most leaders of KIPS through the years would agree there was some accident to this, but it is now the only really viable accreditation facility and professional association for IT people in Canada. It's an organization that has an extensive and fairly mature, I've seen it, a good connection to equivalent bodies around the world. It's an organization which I would agree today does not necessarily count all IT professionals as members, but has the goal of embracing as many of these individuals as possible in the country. It's the organization that needs to be supported. It's the organization that needs to be leveraged. It's the organization that needs to be challenged to very credibly and constructively and appropriately to create a base of certified professionals in this country that are the envy of the world, and to work with that group so that they're aware of the collective competence they represent, and then to continue to move the bar higher. It is very badly needed. And at the same time, I believe that they should, KIPPS should also really have a larger view of the global consequence of certification of the IT industry as a whole. And I know that they're working in tandem with other organizations around the world to get standardization of competencies, because what we clearly don't want to have happening with IT professionals is what's going on with legal and engineering and doctors, where there's inability to move from country to country and things of that sort, or an inability to recognize each other's credentials. So we should in tandem be working on that as well, which actually I'm aware there is various efforts going on to do so.
So that's sort of a natural kind of segue into this sort of follow-up question. And, you know, there's that UN-founded International Federation of Information Processing, or IFIP, which has representation of involving something like 95 countries and about 1 million influencers worldwide. But they have their professional practice program, which received full ratification at the World General Assembly in August of last year, and with their first implementation meeting in Montreal. And this was hosted by KIPPS in October of 2007. I know I've been in the industry a long time, and it appears to mark a historical inflection point and speaks to IT as a recognized profession with global standards, a profession-based code of ethics, and widely adopted professional certification with full implementation to occur in 2009. So you've talked about this somewhat already, but can you comment further on the benefits of this sort of global initiative?
It's bound to have profound implications, definitely benefits. I fear that it's not... that the IT community in Canada is not aware enough of this direction. So, you know, I think KIPPS needs to stand up and help in that respect. But you know, clearly then there's a tremendous amount of work been done. There's a recognition of the issue. It's of global proportions, 90-some-odd countries or what have you. That's a pretty significant cross-section of the industrialized world. There's probably within all the work that has been done within the UN, International Federation of Information Processing, there's a lot of work that we don't need to do again. And there's bound to be a need for a certain level of standardization and sameness. You know, there's bound to be some differences because of different groups working on this. But the power of this in a world that is linked globally, shrinking every day, is that... we are going to understand each other better on a global level, and it's just going to be basically very, very helpful to business and government in sorting out fact from fiction when you're looking at supposed competence. So I celebrate it. I think that's excellent. I think the real challenge, though, will be to make sure that the decisions that are made internationally have real resonance and impact locally. And that is something KIPPS is going to be challenged to do, and as are other organizations that are interested in our competitiveness globally.
You know, we're coming down to the end of this interview, so I usually try to turn it around. Now, you're going to be the interviewer.
Okay.
And the interviewee. So if you were the interviewer, what kind of questions would you ask yourself, and then what would be the answers?
What I ask myself... you know, Stephen, that's hard. Here's one of the questions I have been asking myself for a couple of years, and it really settled with me when I was in India in February of 2007, where my concern about Canada competitively in a global context merged with my nagging concern about what is the IT contribution that Canada uniquely makes. You know, not too recent history, but, you know, fairly recent history, we had a very dominant Nortel. We had a very dominant Corel. We still have, but, you know, IBM's labs in Quebec. We had Bell Labs. We had a lot of that. I fear that, unfortunately, multinational interests are beginning to dilute what we uniquely do in Canada. Even the Canadarm is being sold. I heard that just a couple of days ago. You know, MDA is selling the Canadarm technology. I think one of the core questions to me as a leader that I put to myself is, what am I doing in my career and through my work that will allow Canada to retain some of this intellectual property and some of the assets, which really come together to create a competitive, compelling sort of Canada on the world stage. You know, you think of Waterloo, you think of the university settings and so on. There's a lot that goes together. Canary, all of these entities, assets, vehicles, which when they work in unison really position us well. You know, as a country, we're debating right now nuclear technology, Chalk River and all of that tobacco. Well, again, you know, that's a technology that we were uniquely known for in the world. And I really lament the loss of that prominence on a world level. So, I can be a critic, I guess. I can simply comment and criticize others, or I can ask myself, what is it I'm doing to buttress my part of the world, the part that I can influence? And my answer to that right now is the next role that I take in employment, I hope, is one where I have some capacity to contribute to that, the answer to that question.
You know, it kind of sort of triggers a thought in you know, this whole discussion in your response. And, you know, there's a study that indicates that South Korea graduates 60,000 engineers a year, the same number as the U.S. per year, even though they have one-sixth the population. And Canada would be, you know, sort of a tenth of that, roughly. China graduates 700,000 engineers a year. So the prediction is by 2010, so we're only talking about 2 to 3 years, 90% of the world's scientists and engineers will be in Asia. And that speaks to things like innovation and intellectual property and the shifts that are occurring. So what's your comment on that?
Well, I had a conversation today, and this is right up this alley, with a university president. And he was telling me that their international student recruiting was focused heavily on mainland China, and would be for the foreseeable future. But we then got into a discussion about how they learn, and how they learn in solo fashion, that group discussion, seminar formats for learning, team-based assignments. All of these sorts of things were challenging behaviorally for the folks from China and actually he was mentioning Korea. I found a similar situation in India, that I found a lot of extremely well book-taught people that could become professional engineers or meet certification requirements and such. But the real part that I find lacking is the basic understanding of how we work, how we interact, how team-based behaviors and the ability to participate on a team have become highly valued aspects of someone's working capability, about how we make decisions, about consensus, about diplomacy, social skills in the workplace, behavioral skills, attitudes around you know, various things. All of these things are key components of an effective business environment. So while I have the fullest respect for all the maths and science grads and such, I am finding myself all the more appreciative of the classics majors and the philosophy guys and the sociologists who have allow us to be natural. Real challenge for these emerging economies is to go beyond simply the book knowledge and to begin to understand how to really blend inappropriately with the work context. Now, that provides us an advantage in the short term, because we're simply not going to be able to duplicate I don't think we're going to be able to duplicate the output of their institutions. But at the same time, if we're building whole people who whole people being individuals who you can relate with, but who can reach into a technical toolbox, certainly, knowingly, but at the same time are not nerds, using that classic pejorative. They're individuals that are whole people. I believe then that we can exploit in a positive sense, we can use the capability that is present in India, China, Romania, Czech Republic, Philippines, and at the same time, though, we can value add to that with our behavior and understanding of how business is conducted in a Western society.
Well, Paul, I really enjoyed this discussion today, and I thank you for taking the time that you've spent here to share your accumulated wisdom and insights with the audience.
Thank you for the opportunity, and I enjoyed it.
You know, and we will continue to follow your continuing contributions into business, industry, society, into profession, and with keen interest. And I know you're this sort of continuing star that reaches out and engages and empowers and so forth. So,
I thank you for the comments, but I just look for an enjoyable job day by day. So, that's fine.